All right, y'all. Welcome to our session, Using Emerging Data in Climate Science to Better Cover Wildfire Smoke's Effects. Before we get started, I just want to ask you all if you could participate in a quick poll with me. How many people in the audience have been covering wildfire or reported on wildfire in the last year or, we'll say, 5 years? Okay. How many of you live on the West Coast? How many of you live in the Midwest or the South? How many of you are on the East Coast? Okay, good. That's a good mix. That's kind of what I was hoping. This session is built in a way that I hope for people who have been covering wildfire for a long time. There's still a lot for you to learn. And for people who are just starting to cover wildfire and wildfire smoke, or thinking about its effects on the communities that you report on, there will be a lot of information and tools that you can start digging into. So you'll see here there is a bit.ly link to a tip sheet. That tip sheet right now is open for anyone to write in. I've had good success at other conferences having the audience take notes as we're going, because Dominic and Jenny are going to give you a lot of really great information. And it seems like a good amount of you have also covered wildfires for a long time and have information, links, resources to share. So if you have a laptop or a phone and want to take notes for yourself and for your colleagues, it'd be great if you put it in there. If you don't and just want to write that down and save it for later, I will lock down the document after this session so everyone's awesome notes and resources can be saved and shared for the whole group. I haven't had any bad actors before. Please do not write inappropriate things in the doc, but I trust none of you to do that. So yeah, like I said, this session hopefully is good for people with different types of backgrounds wanting to report on wildfire smoke and its effects. We're going to start with the basics, and we're just going to talk about where wildfires are increasing in North America mostly. And we're going to cover a little bit about forest management and air quality management, how that relates to smoke. Then we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of the data that you would be wanting to use if you're looking to measure wildfire smoke and its effects on the communities that you report on. And then lastly, we'll talk a little bit more about health and the effects of wildfire smoke on people's health and mental health as well. Yeah, you can also drop questions during the session in the WOVA app. After the session, we'll be taking questions from the broader audience, but I'll also check the app to see if any came in during the session. We won't really be discussing water, but we will be discussing a little bit of forest management at the beginning, especially. I will say I'm Dylan Bergen. I'm a data reporter at MuckRock. We're a nonprofit news site that works mostly in the realm of public records. I'm on our editorial team. We help newsrooms across the country file public records requests and analyze data from public records to do reporting that they otherwise wouldn't be able to do. For the past 2 years, I've been working on air quality investigations, one on urban air pollution in the Chicago area, and then one on wildfires and the Clean Air Act with The Guardian and the California Newsroom, which is a conglomerate of NPR stations. I'll talk a little bit more about that investigation when it comes up in our conversation today, but I'll start with Dominic. Do you want to tell us what you do and how wildfire and wildfire smoke relates to what you do?
Mm-hmm. Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Dominic Della Sala, and it's always a delight for me to be at SEJ conferences, because as a researcher and a conservation scientist, it's always really important for me and that community to be interacting with you folks, because I learn how to be a better communicator in the process. And my career has spanned 4 decades, mostly in forest. I've been blessed by going to some of the most biodiverse forests on the planet, many of which are in trouble. And it was only about 15 years ago that I had a rather auspicious development with fire. At the time, I just finished my book on temperate and boreal rainforests of the world, and I thought I knew what a forest was. And Took a hike on an early spring day to an area close to where I live, at the top of a mountain that had burned severely in a fire. I was with my 8-year-old daughter at the time. We came out of a beautiful old-growth forest, and we sat in this field of burned trees, and my daughter saw all the butterflies and the dragonflies and the birds and the flowering plants, and I changed my perspective on what a forest was that day through the eyes of an 8-year-old, and it launched me into looking at what really happens to forests when they go through big fire events. And I wrote a book, along with Chad Hansen and a bunch of other scientists, subtitled Nature's Phoenix. The second edition of that book is coming out this summer, and it's going to have a lot of information in it about how incredibly biodiverse these forests are when they go through a severe burn. And it sounds counterintuitive, but I'll get into it more in my discussion later. The last thing I'll say in my preface is I also have had that auspicious experience with fire because half of my town burned down in the Labor Day fires. I live in Talent, Oregon, and that fire... You live in Talent?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How come I don't know you?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry for interrupting.
I share your pain. It came within 3 blocks of my doorstep, and I saw the whole thing.
Exactly. I live near Talent Mobile Estate. Yeah.
Then you lost a lot, because the whole mobile estate park was taken out. So that's my interesting story preface with fire, both as a publisher, a researcher. I also can get into the climate angle, and I know water is not part of it, but I could delve into the aquatics a little bit on the Q&A if you want, but mostly on the ecological, the carbon dynamics in terms of what happens to forests with carbon exchange, and the personal experience with losing half of my and your town. We have talked. I recognize you now. Yes. I'm glad you're here. So thanks.
Jenny, do you want to tell us about yourself?
Sure. Wow. Small world. So I'm Jenny Bratbird. I work over at University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm the outreach program coordinator for the NASA Health and Air Quality Applied Sciences team, which is a group of 14 scientists around the country from Alaska to Florida, who are using satellite data and other NASA data to help measure air pollution and help stakeholders across the country and around the world. I'm also helping with a lot of research at University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Climate Solutions for Health Lab, where I work a lot on climate mitigation and the co-benefits from that.
Thanks. Okay, first to the kind of basics part of this conversation. Dominic, can you tell us a little bit more about where wildfires are increasing and the fundamental root causes ecologically?
Yeah, so I want to unpack a few things when it comes to wildfire. And as I mentioned in my previous comments, I had to educate myself in terms of what a forest is. Because, you know, I really thought I knew what forests were because I'd spend over 3 decades of my career doing these bioblitzes where we're among a team of scientists. We would go into these places and we would catalog them as quickly as we could in hopes that, you know, they wouldn't be cut down. And so I did this for over 3 decades and started accumulating all this information on old growth forests, for example, and different parts of the planet and how important they are to so many things that we need from nature. But it wasn't until I saw what was going on in these burned forests that it changed my whole perspective, that they're as biodiverse as an old growth forest is. It's just a different community that's in there that isn't necessarily the same community in an old growth forest, but it's equally important. And we can get into some of those differences that I see because we're seeing this in so many different places around the planet. And these natural fires, now I'm not talking about what's going on in the tropical rainforests, which are not natural fires. They're anthropogenic slash and burn fires that shouldn't be happening. But in terms of wildfires burning through these forests, this is the thing that's going to sound counterintuitive to a lot of folks, that not only are these ecologically important and unique systems that are quite resilient to fire and have adapted over eons to coexist with fire in the landscape, but we actually have a fire deficit. We have fewer acres burning now than we did pre-contact during dry periods before European colonization. Based on the paleo charcoal record, there, you know, these fires, what they do is they track drought cycles. And when there are extended droughts, there are big fire events. When there are long periods of dry, hot conditions, there are big fire events. The Big Burn, Timothy Egan's book, the 1910 fires in the Rockies. A lot more was burning, especially with the indigenous footprint on the landscape as well. And so we're in a fire deficit across all fire severities, whether it's low, medium, or high severity. All fire severities are in a low or a deficit. Now, that's changing. And the patterns that we're seeing from the 1980s on, we've seen an increase in acres burning in the West, for example. And we've got some research coming out in terms of the cause and effects for what happened in Ontario and Quebec last year. That was just mind-boggling to me, that I was in the process of going through this with a team of scientists from Canada and also from Australia, Griffith University. We now have a lot of information on those fires that I wish I had when they were burning. It's like, oh, this is the news cycle, and I can't comment on it now because it's in peer review. And so what we're finding is not only are we in a deficit and it's increasing now, the acres are coming back up, but there are two primary triggers. And I'll tell you that we're seeing this in four or five different biogeographies around the planet. In Canada last year, in Ontario and Quebec, in British Columbia, where I also have study plots, in the Western United States, and my colleagues in Southeastern Australia, all seeing the same thing. We're going to publish a paper on this at some point. The two factors that really are pushing these big fires that are starting to build back up and fill in that deficit that I mentioned, anthropogenic climate change and forest management, and the amount of logging that happens on the ground influences how severe those fires burn. So let me dissect that a bit further for you. So when we look at anthropogenic climate change, there are a number of factors that we can see that are changing, that are really pushing these big fires. The two biggies are the extreme temperatures during the summertime and the vapor pressure deficit, which is a measure of atmospheric moisture. And those two combinations are in place, and you've got high winds, you've got the recipe for a big burn. And that's what's driving these fires. Now, where they burn more naturally are in the older forest. Where they burn more intensely are in the young plantations, the managed forest, where they've been logged. That's exactly what happened in Ontario and Quebec last year. It was a trigger caused by anthropogenic climate change. Those two variables were really behind it, on top of extensively logged landscapes. There's so little left in Ontario and Quebec, we had a difficult time finding where the remaining primary forests are. There's hardly any big blocks of it, and woodland caribou are circling the extinction drain, so they're one of the canaries in the coal mine that is saying, hey, wait, we're taking too much. And so now, not only are we affecting the biodiversity, but we're affecting how these fires burn. And they burn more intensely where we see more heavy forest management like that on top of the climate signal.
Well, this is a good question. And I think why is the right question. But also I wanted to ask, as a part of that, if you could break it down a little bit more. I'm not sure. Are you saying that forest management is the solution or increasing the problem?
It's making it worse. It's making it worse for a number of reasons, because the why part of it is, I mean, on the climate when you dry out a landscape, you're going to predispose it to fire. When you heat up a landscape, you're drying it out. You're increasing evapotranspiration. The forests are getting drier, right? So you've already primed that fire pump. Now you throw on top of that heavily logged forests where you either have a lot of slash on the ground, which is kindling, or you've got trees that are planted in tight rows and they just burn right through. It's like throwing gasoline on the fire. And so when you've got a natural forest, you've got a lot more variability in there. You've got heterogeneity on the landscape so that you might have places that have young forest, old forest, everything in between. It's not one big tinderbox that's all going to go up the same time. Now, you throw on top of that, we haven't talked about this either, but you throw on top of that roads. When you've got a lot of roads on the landscape, you've got an increased probability and risk of fires. And that we know that some of the studies that have come out in the western United States, over 80% of the fires over a two-decade period are human-caused. So the more roads, the more fires. So we could manage these fires by reducing at least the human element in the equation and by not taking out the last remaining old forest, the primary forest, which are really kind of acting as fire refugia. Because what's going on is that when the fires do hit those older forests, and this is on average, there are exceptions to everything in this, but this is an average, when the fires go through a landscape, they tend to lay down in the older forest unless they're really racing in high winds. And the older forests are better equipped at handling that because they don't have the small trees that are going to be the kindling. You have canopies that are more diverse in those forests, so the fires aren't just lighting right through the canopy. They might hit a spot that's an opening in the forest and not be able to burn as much than by comparison if you're in a plantation. So these older forests are actually more resistant and resilient to fire, except when we change the climate on them. When we change the climate to the point where we've got extreme climate change, all bets are off. But I'm just talking averages, and in general, the older forests are acting as fire refugia.
And can you talk a little bit about the dichotomy that we often see of good versus bad fire? How does what you said play into that?
I really hate that, and I'm glad that it's on there as a question, because it really is subjective. And again, you know, I go back to my experience with my 8-year-old daughter. When I came out of that old growth forest that was sitting there on a beautiful spring day, the snow had just melted. And I'm sitting in the forest and all the trees are dead, but they're tall trees. They're big trees. So it used to be an old growth forest, not talking about a plantation. I'm talking about an old growth forest that had a severe burn through it. And the bird community was, there was more bird sound in that burnt forest than there was in the old growth forest. And there were more pollinators and more flowering plants. It was a different community of species. And so I get it. You know, the visual of it all and walking through your favorite hiking place and your favorite campground. And one day it was an old forest and another day it was a burnt landscape. It's very visual, right? And it could be... you can get an emotional response from it, but you got to go back a year, 10 years, 15 years after those burns. The other example I'll give you is I was on the ground in the 1988 Yellowstone fires. All the press, oh God, the park's never going to be the same. What a disaster. The Park Service should have put out that fire. It was a year or two later, the place was so alive with lodgepole pine seedlings, with fireweed, with all of these flowering plants. There were elk everywhere. And it was amazing. It was beautiful. And now the Park Service has kiosks on fire ecology. They didn't in 1988, but they do now. And it's because we learn a lot from these burned areas. If we just keep our eyes open, our hearts open, and just kind of look at it through the lens of what nature is trying to tell us and not what our personal subjectivity is, good versus bad. All fires are an ecological process. They're a force of nature. They have shaped ecosystems for millennia, and we have worked with them through indigenous use of fire for millennia. So there really is no good versus bad fire, and I just hope that when you're doing reporting on fire issues, you kind of keep an open mind about fire, because there's no such thing as a bad fire unless it's burned down your town, which is what we experienced. That was a bad fire, but that was an urban fire. That wasn't an ecological fire.
I want to move a little bit in the direction of air quality management. Speaking of shaping ecosystems through fire, Jenny, can you talk a little bit about air quality management and prescribed burns?
Sure. So I guess building off the sort of good fire versus bad fire, we can also think about prescribed fire versus wildfire. So prescribed fires are intentionally burnt. They can help, you know, reduce some of that kindling and, you know, make it so that when a fire does naturally occur, it doesn't become quite so hot and quite so uncontrollable and devastating. And it can also have that rejuvenating impacts for ecosystems. So a lot of places around the country are actually performing these prescribed burns for the ecosystem impacts, for farming practices. It's also been an indigenous practice for many, many years. One of the also thinking about the good versus bad fire, though, from the air quality perspective, is that, of course, they all produce smoke, and smoke is not good for our health. And often what we're thinking about with smoke is particulate matter, or PM, and small particulate matter, it's less than 2 microns. We call it PM 2.5 because it's less than 2.5 microns. It's really not great for your health because it gets pretty deep in your lungs. It's been well linked to premature mortality. It has impacts on respiratory health, cardiovascular health. So generally, we want people to avoid being exposed to smoke, and I think we'll talk about that more later. But so when we're thinking about these prescribed fires, on one hand, there is a huge benefit of being able to control it and help with land management practices, but it also still produces smoke. There is some evidence, not so much for my team, but I'll just say there's some evidence to suggest that maybe these prescribed burns could potentially have less health impacts because they're not burning so hot. They're not, you know, burning, hopefully not burning human structures and releasing different chemicals from that. So potentially there's some benefit there. But for a lot of the communities that face fires, both wildfires, I guess, but also for prescribed burns, that's often happening in these rural communities. It's often in places where they don't have the monitors that maybe a big city has. They maybe only have access to small monitors, or we can measure that with satellite data. I don't know if that answered the question. Okay.
Well, no, that's great. I think I know you're in a lot of conversations with state and local regulators. Can you tell us a little bit about how air quality management works and the way that it balances wildfires and prescribed burns?
Sure. So I could talk a little bit about, so what we're talking about would be the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act has been a huge success in decreasing air pollution. You know, you can see it over the last decade or so. It's phenomenal. It really helps with sources that we have more control over. And the issue now with wildfires is that a lot of those gains that we've had, especially with particulate matter, are kind of being wiped out by the wildfires, which we don't have as much control over. And this is also a part of the Clean Air Act, where we have these what are called exceptional events, where a state can apply to say, hey, this day where we had this huge plume of smoke affect our community, it shouldn't like count against our, you know, yearly record for all the other work that we're doing to control, you know, our local industrial sources or sources from traffic. So they can apply for that, and EPA can decide if they will accept it or not based on certain criteria. But then that was an earthquake. Yeah.
That's what I thought it was too.
Just now?
Yeah, we just had an earthquake. I guess that's what he's saying.
Yeah, about like a few minutes ago.
Yeah. Yeah. or subway or something.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. No, that's not the L. That's not our setup.
It looked like you got warned us.
Yeah. I'll give like everyone a minute to check their phone and see if everything's okay, and then we can get back into it.
Do we have to evacuate? Or
yeah.
I mean, we didn't collapse yet.
Yeah.
My brother in New York City just told me they had it there too. Yeah.
Wow.
The Yankee game.
Yeah. Those are probably going to be postponed. Okay, I think we'll just hop back into things. It seems like everything is all fine. So this talking about exceptional events is a chance for me to plug and also describe the investigation that I worked on with the California Newsroom and The Guardian. So as Jenny was describing, there are these things called exceptional events, or there's a rule in the Clean Act called the Exceptional Events Rule, which allows states to ask the EPA to remove certain days from their air quality numbers that will help qualify them for attainment or define if they're not in attainment, if the event or the thing that affected air quality on that day was basically out of their control in any way. This law has a long history, a complicated history, and has changed a lot since it was kind of loosely organized in the 80s. We cover that a bit in the investigation. But what happens then is the wildfire that could be happening very close to the source or very close to the area in consideration is then used to say that this day was so exceptional that it should not be on the record. Basically, they're trimming their mean and removing these days from the record or from the record that maintains whether they're in attainment or not. This is complicated, as you can imagine, because what gets you so close to not being in attainment with the EPA may be wildfires, or if you're far away from wildfires, it may be industry or other sources of pollution. And what we saw across the country is places that were getting really close to the line of being in trouble with the EPA for being out of attainment for ozone or PM2.5 would cross over the line and start looking for days that were affected by wildfires to bring them back behind the line. We found in Louisiana specifically, the Petrochemical Trade Association in Louisiana was paying for research to show that wildfires were affecting air quality on these days, and then giving that research to the Louisiana EPA for free to then pass on to the federal EPA to say, hey, these 2 days caused our ozone levels to go beyond what we need them to be for attainment. If you take them off, our numbers will be back in attainment. So if you want to check out that investigation, I linked it in the Bitly link and included all the FOIA requests and data. We spent a year getting a ton of documents across the country on these exceptional events demonstrations and on the data that was changed as a result of it. So there are lots of states that I still think would be really interesting to cover, to take a look at in the data that we didn't get to. We worked with the California Newsroom, so we focused primarily on California and then kind of did an overview of what it looked like across the country. But there are a lot of interesting scenarios, and this will continue to be a big question for states. Jenny, do you want to talk a little bit about that? I know, like, after last summer, a lot of states, especially now on the East Coast and in the Midwest, who have maybe out of attainment, say Chicago area, for different levels of pollution, are now saying, oh gosh, we're definitely going to be out of attainment because of the weeks of wildfire pollution that we experienced last summer.
Well, that's why they apply for the exceptional events, because, you know, attainment, like, the way the Clean Air Act is written, I guess, and how the sources that they're able to control, they want to focus on those. And so if you get a random smoke plume from Canada, it's like, well, you know, what can they do in Chicago to stop, you know, have a giant fan or something? Like, right. So that's kind of why they want those to count as, like, exceptional events, to say, okay,
Chicago does have a giant fan. It's the Lake Michigan.
Yeah. The thing is, though, it does take a lot of work to prepare those. I mean, they're talking about putting together, like, 500 pages of documentation, or, like, hiring consultants, which costs a lot of money, or just the amount of time it takes, which is time away from what they actually want to be doing and focusing on the pollution sources they can control. So, you know, and especially with the increasing wildfires, it's a question of, like, well, these are starting to seem less exceptional and more like something we're seeing. What do we need this to look like in the future? Because the way, you know, this is structured right now. It works. It's been working well for certain sources of pollution, but for wildfire smoke, it's it's a lot harder to control, I would say. So,
yeah, I think, and one of the things that we found coming out of that investigation is that states really struggle to put these together. Like Jenny was saying, they're very expensive. We got a lot of the contracts. With the investigation, we published all the contracts that we could get. So you can take a look at those. But they're very expensive. They take a long time to put together, but they're increasingly necessary because wildfires are going to continue to force states out of attainment. So our investigation was kind of drawing into question what role they actually play in a world where their wildfires are not exceptional, and how do you account for them in metrics that measure public health, like attainment, or measure the effects of smoke on public health. But they're only probably going to become more common and more necessary until there's some other solution.
Oh, and I was going to say one more thing. So for like the NASA perspective, like NASA doesn't have a say in the regulation or anything. They're not, that's not what they do. But for us, like we're trying to think about how do we make this data quickly available so that it takes less time. And so that's what we started doing, is making these tutorials for how do you get this satellite data so you can say like, here's this big plume of smoke. Like it's very obvious, especially for some of these like major events where it's like, okay, this is clearly unusual. So just trying to make that easier and more accessible.
Yeah, so I think you took us right into the data portion of this conversation. So let's back up a little bit and talk about how do you measure wildfire smoke? What kind of data is there on wildfire smoke? Is there a sensor or a monitor that measures wildfire smoke specifically? If not, how do you do that?
Yeah, so there is not a specific sensor for wildfire smoke. So often what we're talking about for pollution is particulate matter that I mentioned before. But actually, wildfire smoke produces a lot of different pollution, thousands of different chemicals. It can contribute to ozone would be another major one. So there's a lot that we could measure with wildfire smoke. We often focus on particulate matter because it's so well linked to premature death and health outcomes. So that's why it's a major focus. So if we think about measuring particulate matter, often what we're thinking about is what is the ambient concentration? How do we measure that? And so we could think about, let's say, three different ways to measure that. One is we have these regulatory monitors, usually installed by the EPA. They're very, they're the state of the science, they're the gold standard. They tend to be a bit expensive.
I've read that they cost $40,000 a year to run, or one federal reference monitor. That's as opposed to what you'll see like with purple air sensors, which like you'll hear Jenny and I calling one thing a monitor and one thing a sensor. Often sensors are the low quality or low cost, lower quality air sensors. They function very well for all sorts of purposes, but often you have to apply a correction to them, especially during wildfires. So a correction is like a mathematical formula that takes into account things like humidity. The federal reference monitors are, like I said, $40,000 plus a year to run, and they are the gold standard. And they calculate things differently. They measure things differently. The hardware works differently, but they are what you can take someone to court with, and they are used to take people to court.
Right. And yeah, so the low-cost sensors, so obviously they're a lot less expensive, but they come with some data quality issues, which you can address in different ways with the correction factor. You can also co-locate them next to the federal reference monitors and see, you know, what their bias is for that particular instrument. And also some of our researchers, they have like networks of these. So if you have enough in an area, you'll capture a lot more information and hopefully have less bias than if you have one instrument that's, not as good as the others. You can see that if you have a whole bunch. But they're not up to the standards of, the federal monitors. The other way we could think about measuring this is from space with satellites. So with satellite instruments, we can measure the column of air from space. So the advantage here is that you can see a whole large area at once. You can see places where you're not individually placing a sensor or a monitor, which there's a lot. There's a disadvantage in that you're looking down from space, you're looking at this total column of air, when really, for health purposes, what we care about is what we're breathing here at ground level. So there's different ways to correct for that as well. So those are three different ways of thinking about it. And I'm just saying, so that's like measuring your ambient concentration. But you had asked about, like, well, what about wildfire smoke? So that's thinking about the emissions itself. And so if you had, like, an industrial plant or something, you could put a sensor or a monitor right at that industrial plant, but you can't exactly do that for a wildfire necessarily. So a lot of times what people do is combine it with modeling or different techniques to try and determine how much of the particulates are coming from smoke versus other sources.
Yeah, that's great. I think I'd like just to reemphasize that, like, you have a satellite, obviously, and you are able to see what type of smoke exists in the column. And then you have a ground level monitor that can tell you what the level of particulate matter in the air is on the ground. But with the ground level monitor, you can't distinguish immediately between what's backdrop pollution, like what's always there in the background, and what at that moment is from wildfires specifically, depending on how close they are. I see some questions. If you could put it in the app or wait till the end, I'm also going to have to speed us up a little bit. That's important because there are different ways to report on air pollution from wildfires. Sometimes you'll see, like the story that I linked from the Washington Post in the tip sheet, just a quick explainer on the daily average concentration of PM2.5 in the air on a day where people know the air was affected by wildfire smoke. That doesn't distinguish between what exactly is from wildfire smoke or what is not. Or you'll often see really great graphics of smoke plumes using satellite data. To put those two together, like Jenny said, there are teams of researchers who do some modeling to say, okay, if we know that the ground level concentration of PM2.5, for example, is X percent higher than normal, and there is also a smoke plume in the sky, then we can estimate that the difference between the usual concentration of particulate matter and the concentration on that day with the smoke plume overhead is the result of wildfire smoke directly. I linked to a story I worked on using some of that data. The team's data that I was using is a team out of Stanford at the ECO Institute led by Marissa Childs. It's a really awesome data set. I haven't seen it being used a lot by journalists. It's a little bit complicated because it's like 100 by 100 meter grids. So getting it to a county level or a level where most readers would understand is a little bit tricky. But if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Yeah, do you have anything to add to that, Jenny? Otherwise, I think I'll move us on to the direction of the health impacts of wildfire smoke. Actually, one more thing. I did want to talk about the new satellites. Because that's kind of your area of specialty. Can you tell us, like, what their new satellites, and they're getting better at giving us a higher resolution or like a higher, a smaller area on the ground that we're looking at? So, like I said, like 100 by 100 meter grid or a county as the resolution. These satellites are getting better with resolution and quicker in the time periods that they're able to report, right?
Yeah, so there's a couple new satellites that are going up. One that went up last year, and the data is just about to become public later this month, I believe, is the TEMPO instrument. So TEMPO is very... TEMPO, yeah. T-E-M-P-O. So we're all very excited about this. And it's... a new research instrument, and part of what makes it different from a lot of the other instruments that NASA has is that it is what's called geostationary, so it's sort of fixed in one location above us. The other instruments that are comparable are more what we call polar orbiting, so they're kind of constantly orbiting around the world. The nice thing about the polar orbiting ones is that they'll often pass over a given location on the Earth once per day, but then you only get that once per day snapshot. So with TEMPO, because it's geostationary, it's giving us data over the same place from Canada to Mexico, and it's going to give us hourly data. The other thing that's very exciting, beyond that temporal resolution is also the spatial resolution. It's going to be a lot finer. So I was just looking this up to be like, older instruments were on the order of maybe like 20 by 20 kilometers or 5 by 5 kilometers. So this one is going to be in some fields of regard 2 by 4 kilometers. So wow. There's potential for a lot higher spatial resolution as well as the temporal resolution, which if you're thinking about any pollution source, not just wildfires, there's a lot more potential to measure what's actually happening with that source during daylight hours when it monitors.
So you would be able to tell then with a finer spatial and temporal resolution, like the plume is at this level. I say before you were like looking at, I don't know, a larger area. Now you can say the plume in this larger area is at this height, but in this part of the plume, it's lower or higher. Like you will be able to, instead of just seeing over a broader span expanse that this estimated area is all at this height, you'll be able to see a finer level of where the plume is at different, at a finer.
That I'm not sure. So okay. I know the spatial resolution when we're sort of mapping it on to the ground is finer. I'm not sure how they're going to be changing the algorithms for measuring at different levels. So that's a good question.
Got it. We'll get out of the weeds and head to the health impacts.
Just a quick question. Okay. I mean, even though the satellite is far, far, farther away than polar orbiting satellites, it is that spatial resolution is that much better?
Yeah.
It's just a better instrument than we've ever had before? Or? It's 22,000 miles away.
Yeah, it's a really good instrument, and it's part of this constellation around the world. There's one over Asia, and they're putting one up over Europe. So yeah, there's a lot that's happening with new technology. I mean, there's other NOAA also has some geostationary satellites too that also help with forecasting. So There's a lot that can be done, but yeah, the technology has really changed over the years, which I think is why it's so much better now.
Moving into the health impacts of wildfire smoke, Dominic, I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about your experience and talent. And the reason I ask is just because I think we're going to talk about some really concrete health effects, but also the broader mental health and effects on people's livelihoods. That I think are important when reporting on wildfire smoke and how it's changing people's lives across the country.
Yeah, again, I've had this amazing experience with wildfire on so many levels, the experience of just educating myself about the beneficial effects ecologically of wildfires. There's also carbon dynamics that happen in these forests too. They're not a big source of carbon emissions. We've been talking a lot about all these other pollutants in the atmosphere, but carbon's not one of them. And we've got some really interesting plots on the ground where we've been measuring carbon flux coming from these big burns. And most of the carbon stays in the big trees. And some of it is volatilized in the lower levels of the forest. But the experience I wanted to share with you is personal for me, and it sounds like for you too, April. But here's the weird thing about it. On the day of the Labor Day fires in 2020, before the fires were even known, I was in front of my computer screen writing an op-ed, probably for one of the papers that you folks work with. And I was really worried about it because I, as a climate change conservation scientist, I spent a lot of time tracking the latest climate attribute models in terms of what are the conditions that are going to likely cause a fire. And so I usually look at the drought maps. For instance, USGS has drought maps, and I know, okay, this region is in extreme drought. They're probably going to get a big burn this year. And so I was doing that, and I was writing an op-ed, and my power went off, kind of like the earthquake a little earlier today, just the unexpected, right? So my power goes off, and even though I don't have power lines to my house, I just go outside. What happened? And there it was, the start of the Almeida fire. I'm sorry you lost your part of the town.
Oh, I was across from the mobile estate.
Okay, so you were across. So you were in the safe zone. Yeah, you were very. You were closer than I was. I was about three blocks away. So this was happening while I was writing the op-ed, and it was a surreal experience for me because I had been arguing for years that everything that was being done in the backcountry was not helping what was going on with these communities, that they were just not being prepared for the risk of fire. Miles away where forest management was happening wasn't going to help any of these towns. And then my town burned down. And it was an incredible psychological experience for me. And my house didn't burn. It came three blocks shy of where I live. But I was an evacuee for 10 days, sleeping on people's couches. And when I came back, I couldn't go outside. The air was unhealthy. It was unbreathable. It was hazardous. And I've lived in this community now for 26 years. And when I first moved there, I loved the summers. The summers were incredible in Southern Oregon. I'm also a professional musician. And so I try to get all my concerts in now before 4th of July because now we enter smoke season. Can't go outside. My band gets canceled routinely from July through September. The air's gotten so bad. And it's not just because fire's burning in my area. It's all over the place. And you know, the jet stream has been contorted. We know that polar vortexes are moving around and giving us snowmageddons in the Northeast and silly congressmen that claim climate change isn't real because the polar vortex has been collapsing and it's changing the jet stream. And so in the process of the jet stream dipping into my region, I get the fires from British Columbia. Or if the flow is coming reverse, I get the fires coming up from California because I live in a little box canyon. And so I don't have summers anymore. I have smoke season. And I also, the other experience I'll share with you is I was giving a talk once in Santa Fe on the need for more prescribed burning. And prescribed burning is a good tool. It's not going to solve the fire problem, but it's a good tool that can have a contribution. And I talked about the importance of prescribed burning, and in a very friendly crowd, I got booed off the stage. And I was surprised by that. And it was because Santa Fe is experiencing more smoke collectively from all the prescribed burning than they were getting from natural fires. And it was causing all kinds of asthmatic problems. People couldn't go outside, psychological problems. So, I mean, there's a lot going on with this fire thing. It's kind of a Rubik's Cube of complexities that need to be solved. And the human health one drives a lot of emotions, which in turn drives the, it's pushing a drive for quick fix solutions that are going to do more harm in the long run, because you've got pretty green people now that are saying, cut down the trees and you won't get the fires. But that's not really going to help. It's going to actually put more carbon into the atmosphere that down the road is going to cause or contribute to more of these fires. So there's a lot of psychological issues that are going on, and I can personally attest to what happened with my community. You know, and there's a silver lining in it. The town is rebuilt. The downside of it is they rebuilt using the same flammable structures, no home hardening, no defensible space, and they're just kicking the can down the road. We've already seen examples in California of towns burning more than once over several decades in big fires going over the same fire footprint. So if we don't prepare today, the next generation in that community is going to potentially experience another catastrophic loss because we're not paying attention to this problem at the wildland-urban interface, right at the level of home ignition. That's where you solve this. You don't solve it in the backcountry. You solve it right at home ignition.
Jenny, can you talk a little bit about the effects of wildfire smoke on people's health, more specifically people who have underlying conditions or are vulnerable in some other way? What do we know about how, for example, PM2.5 or other pollutants in wildfire smoke, like you noted earlier, as they do end up burning man-made structures and releasing all kinds of different types of toxics, how does that affect people breathing it?
Sure. Yeah. So, particulate matter, is linked to premature death. It's linked to, lung cancer, COPD. It also has cardiovascular effects. These are, pretty well studied, but more and more, we're also finding, other health impacts, like the mental health impacts, are starting to become more obvious. There's a lot of research ongoing that's sort of looking at like adverse birth impacts. So there's some pretty well-studied health impacts that we know of. And then there's more and more that we're starting to see these links. And we're starting to understand that, and that's part of why the EPA dropped the standard for the particulate matter. Why they lowered it was in part because there's so much health research to indicate that, like, actually it's still harmful even at a lower level, so we need to aim for a lower level. I feel like there was a lot in your question.
I think you've covered the basics of respiratory health and how PM2.5 affects respiratory health. I think what you said about mental health is really important. That's something that I've seen reported on, probably not as extensively as the physical health question, but I linked in the tip sheet to an article by Grist, or by a reporter from Grist that I thought was really great. I've also seen in terms of the effects on physical health, one common proxy for understanding or portraying the immediate physical effects of wildfire smokes is the number of ER visits for asthma accidents at a local hospital on a day when there was extreme wildfire smoke. That's always an interesting data point to bring in. Yeah, I think one other thing that I haven't seen reported on as much that I'm really interested in as well, and was talking with these two before the panel, is the effects of wildfire smoke on workers, especially in the summer or during smoke season, who can't go inside, so farm workers and construction workers. In 2019, California enacted an emergency regulation to protect workers from wildfire smoke and requiring these businesses to outline how they're doing that. I would be interested in states that have similar rules or regulations recently or are moving towards something like that, how they're going to enforce that for workers in the summer that are working construction or working farm jobs. We're probably at a good point to move to questions. Do you two have anything you want to round out the conversation with before we move to questions?
You know, I'll just say I'm with you there on the vulnerable populations, especially for outdoor workers, and I'll also add firefighters. Right. You know, there's a big question, and I know I've been focusing a lot on PM2.5, but obviously there's lots of other chemicals that needs a lot more research, but also there's impacts when you combine it with heat, especially for these vulnerable populations, because, you know, a lot of times they'll say, well, we'll give each worker a respirator or something, but then if it's hot and it's smoky, you know, that has more effects.
Yeah, and I would also say, that was really close. I would also say I've seen some research on the changing pollutants of wildfire smoke or their toxicity as wildfire smoke moves larger distances, which is something to keep in mind. I really don't know much about it. I've seen that research, but I think it's worth considering, because whether you live near the perimeter of the fire or in where the fire is actually happening or on the other side of the country or in a different country, wildfire smoke in one place is going to be different and have different health effects than in another place.
I got one rounding point too. Mm-hmm. I just want to maybe just close on three points of my part of the panel here. One, they mostly refer to, we're not getting out of this problem unless we do three things. And those three things are, we've got to solve climate change because it's only going to get a lot worse. And again, I spent a lot of my time working on climate attribute models and listening to the UN Secretary General about the latest red alert issue to the globe, and yet we have unprecedented releases of emissions. So we're going to get this problem escalating, and it's going to happen pretty soon when we cross 1.5. So we've got to get off of fossil fuels. We all know that. The second thing is we've got to hold the carbon in the ecosystems that we have that do a really good job of filtration, carbon storage, carbon sequestration. The old forests, the unlogged forests, are the best terrestrial sinks on the planet. So the more we log those, the more we put emissions into the atmosphere, the more we cause the feedback that we're trying to solve. And the third thing that we've got to do is we've got to focus strategically on the communities. The infrastructure bill, while it's doing a lot of great things for renewable energy, is the wrong approach on forest management. There's hundreds of millions of dollars going into backcountry logging, biomass utilization, all of that is the wrong direction. It's only going to make it worse for communities. More money's got to go into home hardening, defensible space, smoke shelters, working with the health professionals on disadvantaged communities, BIPOC communities that are often in the front lines of climate change impacts like this. That's where it has to go. Logging in the backcountry is only moving us away from the solution.
I just want to add one thing, especially for this audience, is what we're actually, you know, when we think about the pollution, the other thing to think about is exposure. And so part of that is, you know, work, how that gets out to the public and how they understand the smoke and health effects and how, you know, much information we can give them about, like, what's happening right now, which I think is really important for an audience of journalists, because, you know, there are steps you can make, like having those shelters and, like, helping those communities have those shelters, but it's also, you know, what people can do to help protect their health. So I think that's a really important aspect that we're thinking about of how can we make more accurate forecasts and how can we get that information out to people.
Thank you. All right, we are ready to open it up with questions. I'm going to check the app. Oh, I'll start letting people ask questions. But I just want to say, if you can identify yourself, who you are, and where you're coming from or where you work, before you ask your question, that is an SEJ policy. And if you don't, I will probably ask you to do that. So with that being said, this person right here, can you introduce yourself and ask your question?
It was my study, by the way.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, some of the research that I've been doing is linked to the water cycle, right, and the ways in which industrial logging totally undermines the water cycle and, you know, makes forests more flammable by drying out the soil, by cutting old growth trees that probably transpire the most, by poisoning the understory deciduous plants, et cetera.
It's a good study.
but can you say a little bit more about the water cycle linked to the fire?
Yeah, real quick, the study she's referring to is Bradley et al. I forget where we published that. I think I was the third author on that paper. But what we looked at was, well, I hear all the time when I testify in Congress, oh, if we only had more forest management, we'd have less fires. So we actually tested the hypothesis. We set up using the USGS data sets on fire severity over a four-decade period in 11 western states, 1,500 fires, whatever the total was, 25 million acres burning. We found the opposite. The fires were burning most intensely in the heavily logged areas, least intensely in the places that were protected, like wilderness, roadless areas, old forests. Similar to what we're finding in Canada, what we're finding in Australia, it's the same pattern, okay? So that's what that study basically said. It was the opposite. And I actually got the brainstorm about it after testifying, and I think it was Congressman Westerman's, one of his crazy hearings on fire. I decided to test the hypothesis. Regarding the aquatic cycle, and this will be in my new book on Nature's Phoenix, which is the second edition coming out in June, there's a whole section on this. What happens with wildfires? Wildfires are host experiences to the ecosystem. Roads and logging are chronic press disturbances. They last over a long time period. So with respect to, like, the aquatic system, the most smoke is good for fish. It actually provides cooling effects they do better. But you get that pulse, and a high severe burn will produce a nutrient flux that may kill salmon beds, for instance, in the first year. But 2-3 years down the road, that's an issue. systems respond really well if there isn't logging in the watershed, because fish can move around, find some cool spots that didn't burn intensely, and then get that pulse of nutrient and aquatic invertebrates that hit 3 years after fire. So it could be good. The problem is that when you superimpose like post-fire logging onto that, then you've got the chronic effect of constant sediment flux into the stream. So that's the bad part of it. Wildfire gets blamed for it, but it really is what we do to the landscape after fire. And initially, that first year or so is not a good thing for fish, but 2-3 years down the road, and if there's refugia in place, they get through it, and then they do better, because then you also have logs that go into the stream, which is great fish habitat. That's such a great observation. If there's one thing I can leave you all with that have been covering fires, the thing that's frustrating for me is that the news coverage is always devastation, and rightfully so. If somebody's town is burning down, like my town, your town, that's the correct reporting, right? But go back to these places and go to the places that are burned 5 years ago, 10 years ago, and see what's going on there. It really is fascinating. I'm glad you were able to see that. There's just not enough news coverage of what happens to these forests after they burn. We've got all kinds of time series video of it that I could direct you towards to see this unfolding. It's really quite startling and fascinating, and it never gets the coverage that it deserves. Yeah, the level of logging is correlated with the intensity of fire, is basically what it comes down to, in addition to other factors, okay? The interesting thing is, and I didn't do this study, but folks at Oregon State University did, Downing et al., 2023, published a paper that showed, I think you guys might have covered this on one of your radio programs, if I recall correctly, the fires that were impacting towns were actually spilling out over from the private lands, more so than public lands. Yet all the attention, all the focus is on, we got to log more on public lands. Public lands gets blamed all the time. But where we're seeing the most intense burning is in places that have had the most logging, which tend to be the industrial lands, right? They always get off easy, and yet they're contributing to the problem. And that study by Downing et al. From Oregon State University should have gotten more coverage, because it really kind of goes against the grain of what you're going to hear from the timber industry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Chad is a friend of mine. He's a colleague, and he and I differ on some things. We agree on other things. The problem when stuff like that gets around, the coverage doesn't include the rebuttal. And Chad has rebutted every one of the criticisms that were levied against him. typically those criticism are coming from researchers that have ties to Forest Service funding. Always follow the money. And the thing that I've learned about wildfire over the years is that perspectives matter. And the thing I'll share with you is I was on a busload of reporters that the Forest Service did this field trip on the Biscuit Burn in Southwest Oregon back, I think it was 2002 or somewhere around there. President Bush even came out for that event. That's how much attention it got. The whole bus was packed with reporters, Forest Service people, folks from the timber industry were looking at the same site. Oh, my God, what a disaster. We got to get in there with herbicides. We got to log. The trees are never going to come back. Excuse me. I got a question. What are all those seedlings that I see out on the landscape? What about those big trees that didn't die? You want to take them out and salvage logging? We were looking at the same landscape. We had completely different views. So when it comes to wildfire, depending on where you get your funding and what your questions are, involving the contracts that you have for your funding sources are going to determine what you see on the landscape. This is why Chad gets a lot of flack, because what he sees is different from the Forest Service researchers that are looking at the same block of land differently. And all the years that I've known Chad, he's never loaded any of his stuff that I've worked with him on, but he gets a lot of criticism because the criticism is coming depending on where the money sources are that are tied to the wildfire issue. So when you're covering wildfire issues, it's always, I would advise, keep in the back of your mind if somebody has a conflict of interest. Where's the money coming from that funded the research? If you're talking about, you know, whether tobacco causes cancer, are you going to go to somebody getting money from the tobacco industry? Or are you going to go to somebody that might be getting funding from an independent source? Same thing with climate change. And for years, the coverage was you always had to have some climate denier along with the person saying climate change is real in coverage. It's great that I don't see that anymore. It's all now going in the direction it should be going. But in terms of wildfire, there's this dichotomy, and that dichotomy has a lot to do with perspectives and where the funding sources are coming from. Yeah, good point.
You in the back?
Hi, thank you guys for being here today. My name is Kat Dwyer. I'm not a journalist, but with a conservation group, PERC, based out of Bozeman, Montana. So we live with wildfire, we know it well. My question is just, do you think it's fair to make a distinction between sort of clear-cut logging, which creates sort of these uniform plantation-style forests, as you described, that, you know, make the trees more vulnerable to sort of burn all at once and burn hot, versus sort of what the Forest Service is trying to implement, which is more forest restoration through selective thinning, yes, but also prescribed fire as a way to kind of, in my view, like undo the wrong of fire suppression policy over the last century that has disrupted natural fire cycles. Is there a fair distinction to be made between that type of logging and then the more selective, thoughtful management?
I'm so glad you brought that up. This is so hard to get in it. Like, if I were being interviewed on radio, I'd get maybe 15 seconds to answer that question. It is really a nuanced answer here. So just bear with me for a minute. I'll try to get through it in a minute and a half if I can. Do I have a minute and a half to
answer
that
question? You have a minute and a half.
Okay, thank you. So if you do everything right, in the right conditions, you can lower fire intensity. So here's what everything right looks like. You've got to leave the overstory canopy intact. You've got to leave the fire, the large fire resistant trees intact. You've got to thin from below. You've got to follow with prescribed burning. You've got to keep doing it over a period of time because the vegetation's going to come back. Then you have to be lucky enough to catch lightning in a bottle. So the odds of that site on the ground encountering a fire are really small, maybe 1%. Over a period of time, and you have to keep coming back and investing in that site, hoping that you catch lightning. So everything has got to be done right. Everything is not always done right, and often it isn't. And in order to justify and pencil the logging sale, they take the big trees. And not taking the big trees is the exemption. It's not really the rule with how the agencies do their thinning, because they sweeten the pot, they take big trees. I just gave a talk at the Mature and Old Growth Forest Summit in Washington, D.C. about that. The chief of the Forest Service was in the room, and I showed tons of photos of big tree logging in hazardous fuel reduction projects. So they're not doing everything right. And even if you do everything right, the climate signal is overtaking anything we do on the ground. And so in order to scale up, to increase the odds of a site encountering a fire, you're actually putting more emissions into the atmosphere collectively over a large landscape than the fire is. So you're not really solving the problem. So what I'm saying is that you've got to get more surgical about it. Do it closer to where communities are. Maybe function or focus on the plantations. Those are the big, big problems with fire. And hope that you can get everything right and still solve for the climate issue. That's why it's complex and nuanced. I think I got it out in a minute and a half.
I think it's almost 2 minutes, but that was pretty dang good. Yeah, you right in the front.
I mean, probably for the public, I would most recommend EPA's Air Now. They also have a smoke and fire map. That's really nice, always updated. Includes, with the smoke and fire map, you can see the estimates of the smoke plumes. You can also see what the monitors are lighting up as for their air quality index. And then from there, it kind of depends on how much you want to dig into it. Actually, the EPA site also includes the Purple Air Network, which gives you the low-cost monitors. That's another source to look at if you don't have a local regulatory monitor nearby. But there are other networks, like the IQ Air network. You could also buy, I know groups that have just bought these and placed them in different communities. And, of course, there's the satellite data, which can feed into it. And can also be another way of looking at smoke plumes. And for the easiest way to look at satellite data is to go to NASA WorldView, and you can look for the aerosol optical depth is what it's called, is how the satellites are measuring it. They're looking at how much is being obscured with the smoke. So those are some ways that kind of right off the bat.
Yeah, I'll just add, Muckrock has worked extensively with Cicero Independiente in Cicero, Illinois, and we were able to, like Jenny said, through a grant, buy 5 Purple Air sensors and place those out in Cicero. And I think, well, like I said, the Purple Air sensors aren't perfect for many reasons. We did a call out saying, hey, we have these sensors. Are you interested in air quality in Cicero? You can host these on your homes. We're looking for people in the community who want to do that. We were able to help them set them up and then do kind of short story updates. I think it's really awesome when journalists are able to collect their own data and community members get excited about that as well. And it gives them something really concrete to see and know this purple air sensor is now on my porch or on my back part of my house. You will want to choose someone who does not barbecue in the summer. noticed some initial problems with the data. Yeah.
Collecting stories from folks that had problems during the wildfire smoke days last year, but
Sure. I mean, so I know more about like where you could get maybe the smoke data, but there's lots of different sources for that. It sounds like you would also want to connect with health researchers, so if we can talk afterwards, I can talk about that too. Because it sounds like what you probably want would be to pull the study and work with a hospital maybe to get that, you know, records of asthma admissions during a certain time period.
Eli, Condition with Science Magazine. I've covered climate change for decades now, and, you know, scientists get accused of being doomists or being alarmists, and, you know, covering IPCC reports, say, 15, 20 years ago, you know, they would talk about worst-case scenarios, sea level rise on the East Coast, more severe storms. They might mention fire, but correct me if I'm wrong, I don't remember them saying you'd be unable to go out in Oregon and breathe the air, or, you know, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Bay Area. I mean, I've been shocked at that. I mean, was that in the fine print of the reports and it just didn't get out, or was it actually surprising the scientists that this air quality bugaboo that's transforming America?
Well, I'm glad you're covering it, and first of all, I'm a grandfather, so I'm going to continue to look at the glasses half full, even though there's not a lot of sand in the hourglass. And, you know, we've already gone through a number of red alert warnings from the UN Secretary General, and nothing has changed. We've got the Paris Climate Agreement, and nothing has changed. We've got the Glasgow Forest Declaration, nothing has changed. It's speeding up, and that fact that it's going that quicker is not being picked. It wasn't being picked up on the models because it's going faster than a lot of the models are suggesting.
And were you thinking about air quality? Is it just a surprise?
Well, I don't look at air quality as much as Jenny does, but I think for me personally, and monitoring the other aspects of it, yeah, it is a surprise. And it is going a lot faster than any of these models have projected. I mean, we're on worst case scenario, and we're just now seeing some of the events of worst case. But it's only going to get a lot worse the further away from 1.5 we drift.
I'll just add my sense, and maybe Jenny could talk about this more as well. I think also probably the tools to measure air pollution have changed so much over the last decade or two that I can imagine that as we're having more intense wildfires and the meteorological phenomena that coincide with that carry this smoke, that's kind of a new phenomena. And also being able to measure those effects is probably something I don't imagine one could have imagined 20 plus years ago.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I'm really happy to have been on this panel with Dominic because I feel like a lot of times the air quality world is not necessarily talking to, like, the land management, forest management world. And obviously, like, there's two pieces there. There's the climate piece, but there's also, like, how do we actually work with this? And I think there's been a lot of air quality information sort of on the co-benefits of, like, if we, you know, switch to solar and wind instead of coal, if we switch to electric vehicles, there's less emissions of particulates and various pollutants from that. So there's good news. You know, fire and smoke from that is becoming a big issue too. I think it's being talked about more and more. Just people are seeing it. I know it's pretty well covered in the National Climate Assessment, the most recent one that came out. So, yeah.
I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up for today. Thank you all for coming to our session.